I call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, April 10th, 2026, and I keep forgetting to wish my son a happy birthday. Oh, well. And the time is 3:30. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Meyer, Senator Dunbar, Senator Clayman will be joining us shortly. Senator Kawasaki is on Teams with us today. Vice Chair Willikowski is here with us, and I am Chair Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Chloe for helping us out with the audio and keeping the minutes. We have four bills up today. We're going to start with Senate Bill 226, Homemade Food. Then we'll go to Senate Joint Resolution 20, Clean Up Marine Debris. Senate Bill 208, Agriculture Land Leases. And Senate Bill 192, Evacuation Designation. So, Senate Bill 226, I will invite Sarah Lewis to come forward. She is a professor of Extension Health, Home, Family, and Community Development at UAF Cooperative Extension Service, and she is here to respond to questions that we had. Today is Friday. On Wednesday, related to Senate Bill 226, which is homemade food, reduced oxygen packaging. So my staff, Samantha Freeborn, sent Ms. Lewis the questions, and thank you for joining us today to answer those questions. We desperately needed you the other day.
I am so sorry I couldn't be here that day. Understood. Thank you, Chair and Committee. I'm pleased to be here.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, and I'll let you give your testimony.
All right. So my name is Sarah Lewis. You did a great job with all of the title bits of my name with UAF, but I'm for Southeast Alaska. With most of my programming, I do a lot of food preservation, safe food preparation and preservation at the home setting in Southeast. But statewide, I am the extension specialist related to food entrepreneurship. So that's why I'm very involved with the homemade food regulations have been for more than a decade from back when the cottage food regulations were passed 10 plus years ago. So did you want me to answer the questions or maybe give a little more information about how I come to be here?
Well, that would be great. And then okay. Answer the questions.
Okay, sure. Awesome. So in my role as a specialist related to food entrepreneurship, I can let you know that with the passage of the homemade food regulations, we differentiate them now into homemade food as opposed to cottage food, because cottage food was everything prior to this new one, because this new one is much bigger, much broader. There's a lot more things to teach about it and a lot more nuance with it. So prior to the passing of the homemade food regulations, in a year, I would talk to maybe 30 people about cottage foods, selling, what's allowed, processes, et cetera. In the 3 months after the passage, or actually after the regulations were written in 2024, I spoke with 90 people. And previously, I would talk to people for about 15 minutes. And under homemade foods, I regularly talk to people for 30 minutes to an hour because they're very detailed and people are very interested in it. There's just basically a huge growth in, and I think it's in many ways very, very good. There's a lot of opportunity when it comes to homemade food businesses now. But what brings me here is to talk about botulism and those foods that are currently allowed to be sold as homemade food, but have a high botulism risk. That was one thing that, in my opinion, was sort of missed in the original homemade food bill as being something that is potentially hazardous. And it was the criteria that was used for the original homemade food regulations was temperature and time control, time and temperature control. But there wasn't any anything given to the environment that you package things in. And when you package things in low oxygen environments or removed oxygen packaging, as it's sometimes called ROP, you create a different environment and different bacteria are the problem, are the potential risk. And botulism is the one that is a potential risk when you remove oxygen from the environment around a low acid food. So that's why and botulism as there's documentation with the bill. Brian Himmelblum has given lots of good information about the science behind it. But the real concern with botulism, if you are looking at homemade food sales, is it's not ever going to be just one jar. It's going to be large batches. So if you have a botulism case, it's going to be multiple, regardless of what community it is. And if you are in a remote community, that could be quite a desperate situation if something goes wrong with that entire batch. And I've got examples of from the 70s through even 2024. There are examples in other states. We have never had a multiple case outbreak related to home canned food. In Alaska, we've had a single person outbreak, a single case. So, but part of that, I would like to go ahead and pat Cooperative Extension on the back, is because we've been educating the community about low acid food in jars for decades. And that's one of our primary things that we do. So hopefully that's part of the reason why up to this point we have not had an outbreak related to home canned foods. But also it was never legal to sell them to the public before. It was always for home use. And so I would be happy to answer any of the questions that came up previously or if you have any new ones.
Why don't you start with the previous questions? Sure. I know that Samantha sent those to you.
Yes.
And I suspect they will stimulate some additional.
Certainly. So I think some of them may, Samantha also sent some to other experts, other folks within the state to respond to. And so of the 24 cases of botulism in Alaska, how many of those were from sold homemade food? And the answer is none, because it was illegal to sell these types of food, these potentially high botulism risk foods, without a DEC permit prior to this homemade food regulation being created.
Senator Rauscher, you have a question about that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Sue Chair. So that was my question, but I'm trying to understand, was it been cooked in Alaska?
Yes, my understanding. I think I was able to see that in something that came back from one of the other I'm not seeing it. Maybe Samantha can help. I'm not sure that I printed that one out. But that, yes, when I was looking at those cases, those are all food that was consumed in Alaska.
That were
follow-up, Senator Rauscher?
Yes. That were cooked in Alaska?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. I'll let you go on.
Okay. How do provisions compare to regulations at the federal level? That is one that I believe DEC got back on. And basically, all of those regulations are created at the state level. There's some federal certain businesses, when they are permitted, so permitted through DEC, they need to register with the FDA. And a thing that I do want to note on that is if you do register with FDA, there are actually sort of two categories, or a main category and a subcategory, when it comes to foods that are in reduced oxygen packaging. You actually have to go through some separate, you have to fill out some separate forms and give special information to the FDA, because that is considered a higher risk food. And they specifically call out foods that are high risk for Clostridium botulinum. And that's part of the reason that you have to register separately, even when you're registering with the FDA. But other than that, the regulations are at the state level.
Any other questions about that? All right.
Then there was a question about what is potentially hazardous food? Is it based on acidity? And very basically, a food's level of hazard is based on the risk of bacterial growth. And foods that are low acid and or could be together, high water activity, are those that have a higher bacterial risk. Foods that are high acid and or low water activity are yeasts and molds, is more what you're going to be concerned with, and those are spoilage. Those are not universally harmful to humans. They can spoil food. There are people with allergies and sensitivities, but there are bacteria that are universally harmful to us, and so that's why we get most concerned about foods that are a higher risk for bacterial growth, and that's what turns them, you know, puts them in the potentially hazardous category.
Questions about that? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I worry about how this is phrased. Just it's very broad, and it doesn't, I don't think, gives clear guidance to the public. And I'm wondering, I would feel more comfortable if, and maybe committee members would feel more comfortable if there was a definition. We defined what reduced oxygen packaging is. I think that's helpful. If you were to define for statute, in statute, what potentially hazardous homemade food means, how would you do that? And you don't have to give it right now, but
right.
If you can get back to us, that'd be great. Or if you can give it to us right now, that'd be
good. I believe they actually line that out in the original statute that was passed for the homemade food 2 years ago. So they did actually line that out. And I have to actually agree with you that there are a lot of things that between that statute and the regulations, it took a little while to really make those work together because there was a fair amount of ambiguity in some aspects of it, which has required some dialing in.
Okay. Yes, follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
So there, it looks like there's a definition in 1720.332b.
Okay.
And is that the definition that you would incorporate?
I don't have it in front of me. I apologize. I have read it, and I agreed that what was there did qualify as potentially hazardous foods. I felt that it didn't go far enough when it comes to the special hazard of botulism. It was mostly concerned with your standard bacterial risk associated with time and temperature control, which is a different criteria than for botulism growth.
So, Sarah, this bill, of course, was, I hate to say, written by you. Actually, our alleged drafting wrote it, but you reviewed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so is the addition of the words in reduced oxygen packaging the key to refining potentially hazardous homemade food?
Yes, it is. Because potentially hazardous homemade food can be sold in all kinds of other forms and all kinds of other packaging. A good example is if someone wanted to sell a chicken soup or a beef stew and the beef is USDA inspected. They could sell that fresh, hot, right out of the pan. They could sell it chilled, made yesterday and sold today, but it's been chilled. They could sell it frozen. All this does is remove the option of canning it in a jar. Because that's the concern, is when you can food in a jar, you're putting it specifically into a reduced oxygen package for quality and for sealing that jar so no new bacteria get in. And that is the specific condition. So they could sell it in all those other ways, that just not, if this bill were to pass, just not in a jar.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm curious, we're talking about a very specific situation, but you've talked to a lot of business owners, it sounds like.
Yes.
We're talking about canning, jarring, or maybe vacuum sealing.
Correct.
How many businesses do you estimate that are out there that are currently doing this with?
There are many who are interested. Out of those 90, I'd say maybe a quarter are interested in doing 15% to 25%, that is absolutely right off the top of my head, are interested in doing potentially hazardous foods that they want to pressure can, or they're considering it. I tell them the risks associated with that, and because at this point they're allowed to. So I tell them the risks associated with that. Most people at that point, they will realize that it's actually easier to freeze it. And less liability, that it opens them to much less liability and risk if they freeze it, and it's actually the packaging for that is less expensive. So if they're able to freeze it, they will typically switch to that.
Okay.
Follow-up, Senator Myers?
Yeah, thank you. Thinking about then the packaging and the like, then obviously we buy canned stuff, jarred stuff, vacuum pack stuff in the store all the time. What is the procedure that's necessary to do that commercially? And is something like that available to somebody doing a home version?
And the answer is those procedures are usually pretty industrial, higher pressure, different temperatures, different amounts of time, sometimes proprietary, and in the home use, all we have is a home use pressure canner is what we have. And there are a few different types of those, but they all work pretty much the same way. And it's to bring the pressure inside the canner up to 240 degrees, which is what's required to kill the botulism spores. And you have to add pressure to do that. And that's really the only way to do it in the home setting.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
The definition, I'm still going back to this definition, potentially hazardous homemade food. There is a definition, thank you to Senator Myers for pointing it out, the exact section, because it's referenced incorrectly in fiscal notes. It's 1720-338-10. It says, means food or drink that requires time or temperature control for safety to limit pathogenic microorganism growth or toxin formation.
Correct.
Are you adopting that same definition here?
It doesn't get changed. Okay. That does not. It is unchanged.
So can I
follow up, please, Senator?
Does that include jelly?
No.
Water bath?
No. Because jams and jellies are high acid foods and sometimes also low water activity. So they are not a bacterial risk, even if you put them in a vacuum, a low oxygen packaging. Follow up?
But you get, and maybe dumb question. I mean, I've had jellies that didn't seal right, and you thought they sealed, and they get mold on them.
That's mold, not bacteria.
Different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas botulism can be colorless, odorless, and is a neurotoxin. Whereas there are people who have sensitivities or allergies to yeasts and molds, and usually you can see it, and you can smell it, and you taste it.
So
follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
So. Is mold considered pathogenic microorganism growth?
No. Okay. Not pathogenic. Yeah, it's a spoilage. Spoilage microorganism.
Mm-hmm. Good. Senator Rocher, these are great questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. So you mentioned freezing. By the time people get home, sometimes it's half thawed and they want to stick it back in their freezer. Is there concerns for refreezing?
No, that is a quality issue. That's not a safety issue. So when you freeze something, let it thaw a bit, refreeze it, sometimes things can get a little bit softer, but it's not a safety issue.
But it does not hurt the
No.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, Sarah, the next question. I think you have more.
I think there are more.
Yes.
Questions on the definition of reduced oxygen packaging. And so I went to FDA for this. And this is where, so I can go ahead and read the definition from the FDA. The reduction of the amount of oxygen in a package by removing oxygen, displacing oxygen and replacing it with another gas or combination of gases, or otherwise controlling the oxygen content to a level below that normally found in the surrounding 21% oxygen atmosphere. So that's step one. And then step two is a process that involves a food for which the hazards of Clostridium botulinum and Listeria monocytogenes require control in the final packaged form. So they actually, as a subset to their definition, they do specifically call out Clostridium botulinum as a concern.
Question, Senator Wilikowski.
So, okay, salmon, you jar salmon.
Yep.
Is that considered a potentially hazardous homemade food?
Salmon is not allowed to be sold. There are no seafood that are allowed to be sold as homemade food. At the home level, for your personal use, yes. Salmon is a potentially hazardous food, and so we pressure can it, but it's not allowed to be sold as a homemade food currently.
Follow up?
What would be an example of a potentially hazardous homemade food?
Beef stew, canned carrots, canned potatoes, green beans. So vegetables and animal products are naturally low acid. And if you don't acidify them, they will still be low acid in that jar. And so those are the ones that we would be concerned about. Vegetable soup, etc.
Follow up.
So grow some green beans in my garden. I water bath it. I can't sell it.
You can't sell it, and water bathing isn't a tested safe recipe for canning your green beans from your garden. You would need to do that in a pressure canner for it to be safe.
So, again, just tracking this statute, if under current law, can I freeze my green beans and sell them?
Under current law, actually, you're right. Let me go back to your previous question. Under current law, you could pick your green beans, water bath can them, and currently you could sell them.
And under this law, under this change, you can still do that, can't you? If you
no, because it would be even under water bath canning, that is a reduced oxygen packaging because you are vacuum sealing that jar.
Follow up?
What if I just froze it, threw it in the freezer in a Ziploc bag? I'm not reduced oxygen packaging.
That's great.
I can sell it that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That can still grow botulism, can it?
No, because of the amount of oxygen. It's you've never specifically, it's got the same amount of oxygen in that bag as was in the environment around it when you put it in the bag. You might kind of push some of it out, but it's usually. Mm-hmm. And the other part is you're not holding it at room temperature. So temperature in that one also has an effect. And people don't, when they take a frozen bag of meat or green beans out of the freezer, they know that they need to refrigerate that, or it's eventually going to be very poor quality or become contaminated with bacteria. So people don't assume that you just leave that on the shelf. So you wouldn't hold that for very long at room temperature before you cook it.
So if I take the green beans, put them in the freezer in a Ziploc, I can sell it.
Yes.
But if I take the air out of it via vacuum seal, I cannot sell it.
That would be under this, that would be correct. That would be correct. Because if there's any, at that point, it does become a temperature control issue. Because if it is outside of that freezer, it is at, for any period of time, thawed, it does become a potential botulism risk if you don't open that bag immediately.
Follow up.
These are the kinds of questions I get every day.
He really wants to give people a botulism.
Senator Clayman.
Canning stuff.
Senator Clayman.
I want to move from green beans to fish. I have a very distinct image that I go many places, including Saturday markets and where people are selling home packaged foods, and I see lots of ball mason jars with fish inside, and they're sealed. And that, maybe it's not legal, but it seems to happen all the time. Does this, is that legal today, and would this bill change that with respect to fish?
That is not legal today, and this bill would not change that. Related to fish, no seafood or fish are allowed to be sold as homemade foods. They are entirely.
Senator Clayman.
If I'm seeing fish in a jar, does that mean it's being prepared commercially and put in the jar as opposed to as a homemade food?
You would have to look at the labeling at that point. Here in Southeast, I very, very rarely see anything but commercially produced canned seafood. So I can't think that I've ever seen, other than someone giving me a gift, anything for sale like that.
Follow up?
So when you say commercially canned seafood, does that include canned in glass jars as opposed to canned in
there
cans?
There are some commercial producers who do it in jars.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'll let you move on to the next question.
Okay.
She's answering, Senator Clayman just joined us. She's answering questions that we had last week that my staff sent to her.
Awesome. Of the 24 cases of botulism in Alaska that were listed in a previous document, were those cases prepared and consumed in Alaska? And I believe there was a response from someone that yes, all of those were prepared and consumed in Alaska, and of the 24 cases, no, that was the whole question. Yes, they were, all 24.
Thank you, Sarah. And that was sent to committee members, and it was answered by the Division of Environmental Health, Sean D. Perry. All right, I'll let you go on.
I think there was one more. There was a question about poultry, about vacuum sealing poultry. And poultry is an interesting one in that so all of the meats that are to be sold through the homemade food regulation, they need to be USDA inspected meats or USDA exempt meats. So poultry, when it comes from a poultry farm that has less than 1,000 birds, is USDA exempt. And that is still allowed to be sold as an ingredient in a homemade food. So that was one sort of nuance of that that's important. So yes, poultry products could be in homemade foods. And again, if that was a product with poultry in it that was going to be pressure canned in a jar or water bath canned in a jar, yikes, then that would be in reduced oxygen packaging. Or if it was a, for example, a poultry jerky and it was vacuum sealed in a bag, that also would be that. That would not be allowed because jerkies are often held at room temperature. So you could do those products frozen in non-reduced oxygen packaging, fresh, cold, but not in reduced oxygen packaging.
Very good. Do you have additional questions on your...
There was one more question that came
in.
Okay. About sous vide.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a question about sous vide. So for those who aren't familiar, the process of cooking in the method called sous vide is you place food in a bag entirely in water that is brought above 140 degrees, but it's still kept at a very low temperature. So instead of cooking something at a high temperature for a shorter period of time to kill potential bacteria, you are cooking it for a longer time at a lower temperature. And that has some quality, qualities in food that people like. So sous vide is becoming pretty popular. When you are putting sous vide, the foods into the bag, you need to remove oxygen so that it doesn't float during the cooking process. It's not actually for any antibacterial or protection other than keeping it down in the water. And it's actually being cooked that whole time, so it is at safe temperatures. And it's typically being cooked for immediate consumption or freezing or refrigerating. It's usually not being cooked to be canned.
Very good. I'm going to I know you had a question, Senator Rauscher and Senator Myers, but let me call on Senator Kawasaki because that was specifically his question. Senator Kawasaki, can you hear us? And do you have further follow-up for Sarah on that sous vide subject?
Yeah. No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm getting a more clear picture about how the bill works now with all of the answers to the questions that we got from Sarah. So I thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity. But yeah, I don't think I have any more further questions.
All right. Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through honey in jars, is that out of this bill completely?
It is. Yeah, it's not related to this bill at all or the previous homemade food bill. So honey is actually pretty much unregulated, raw honey. As soon as you... flavor it or whip it, then it would probably be part. It would be part of the homemade food regulation once you do something to it, and that would be a non-potentially hazardous food.
Thank you,
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, I had a question last time about federal law. So current law says homemade food can't include meat or meat products except as provided in Section H. Section H says, subject to the requirements of federal law, a person may prepare some meat products and homemade food containing meat and meat products. I'm kind of trying to figure out what federal law is in this area and how it interacts, because the only answer we had last time was that federal law doesn't apply to homemade food. And so I'm kind of wondering, well, then why do we have it in our statute?
Right. So federal law, the USDA applies to inspection of meat. And so that's what is being followed when they talk about meats in relationship to federal law. It's that you are required to sell, I think it's federally and definitely in the state, to sell commercial meat, it needs to be USDA inspected. So if it's a meat source that is not USDA inspected, except for poultry, if it's less than 1,000 birds, there's always a caveat, then it's something that can't be included in a homemade food. So okay. A game meat. Other meats within the state that may be harvested but are not USDA inspected would not be allowed.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Yes, Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, except for herd share.
That's under a separate statute.
Right. I just want to make sure everybody understands. Yes. Herd share is completely different.
Completely. That's a separate part of that same larger bill a couple of years ago, but not part of the homemade food regulation. Mm-hmm.
Senator Klayman.
Going back to the sous vide, and this may have nothing to do with the bill, but I'm periodically hear a lot of concerns about plastics. And so sous vide, you're taking Ziplocs and putting them in 140 degree water. Are there concerns with contamination from the plastic?
I am not an expert in that other than to say that if it is a food grade plastic, there should be no issue with it. So food grade plastic. And then you also need to look at the packaging to make sure that it's something that can be heated. So,
yeah. But in the contamination that we're talking about, that's not an issue.
No. Yeah. I mean, there are plastic bags that you use for vacuum sealing. So, but that's a different thing than what you're talking about. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. I see no further questions. Thank you.
You're so
very
welcome.
Much.
Thank you very much for having me.
This issue was brought to me by Sarah at a Circumpolar Agriculture Conference. And I will tell you that I looked at that and said this should be a pretty straightforward issue. However, you can see that it is not. And so I'm really glad we opened Pandora's box on Wednesday with all these questions. And so I felt we needed to have them answered. But I am setting the bill aside at this time.
Pandora's
jar. Yes, you are correct. Thank you. So this bill has been set aside. It'll be pursued in the future. Thank you, Sarah. Great clearing up all these questions, and for not only the committee but the public. Next, we'll go on to Senate Joint Resolution 20, Clean Up Marine Debris. So I will invite Senator Jesse Bjorkman forward. He has his staff with him, Savea Bieber. And looks like, hold steady, we'll go to that. There we go. And online is Mike Levine, Senior Director, Alaska Programs, Ocean Conservatory. But first, Senator Wilikowski, do we have... Do we have a committee substitute on the resolution?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski? A motion? Yes.
Take a brief at ease.
Yeah, brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Bjorkman, you were going to review for us the material in Senate Joint Resolution 20.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, and I represent the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. Thank you for hearing SJR 20 today. Senate Joint Resolution 20 urges federal funding to provide for further efforts to prevent, cleanup, and remove, as well as backhaul marine debris from Alaska's shores. Many communities and organizations have been attempting to clean up Alaska's 44,000 miles of shoreline for years. In 2025, 27 entities coordinated to remove marine debris across Alaska, and together more than 1.5 million pounds of debris were removed from our beaches. Backhaul of marine debris is the most difficult portion of this equation. Distance, expense, and extreme conditions make these removal missions challenging. This results in communities and tribes being left to deal with this trash that they did not contribute to or create or spread. A healthy ocean is vital to life in Alaska and its coastal communities. Continuing to let this trash build and spread would be detrimental to our way of life. I urge your support of SGR 20.
Thank you very much. Senator Rausch, your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one small question. It's on page 2. It's line 26 and 27. It's part of what you had just mentioned, but I want to understand it. Remove barriers faced by tribes and rural communities in accessing those funds. What does that actually mean for me to understand?
Senator Rausch, through the chair, I think that would be a good question for our invited testimony.
If you would identify yourself for the record.
For the record, Savea Bieber, staff to Senator Bjorkman.
Okay, thank
Very
you.
Good. We do have online Mike Levine, Senior Director, Alaska Programs, Ocean Conservancy. Mr. Levine?
Senator, so I'm actually here.
Oh, you're here. All right. Oh, it does say in room. Okay. Having trouble reading today. All right. Welcome, Mr. Levine.
Thank you, Chair Case, all members of the committee. Thank you, Senator Rauscher, for the question. And through the chair, your question is specific to the barriers to accessing federal funds. The one that comes most immediately to mind is a match requirement in many of the federal grant programs. And so tribes are required to come up with a, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it's 10 or 20 or maybe even up to 50% match in order to access these funds. And that's an onerous requirement for a small community that's accessing, seeking funds to clean up marine debris. The other kinds of barriers are simply related to the onerous nature of applying for and accessing the grants. And we have worked through the agency at Ocean Conservancy and some of our through our Senate delegation to try to get reductions or changes in the rules, regulations, and laws. And so this would be having the legislature sort of take the support to support easier access to these federal funds. And it's gotten to be that one of the things that happens is entities like Ocean Conservancy and Alaska Sea Grant will apply for the grants and then try to ease those burdens by having a competitive subgranting program. But it would be better all the way around if the money would just go straight to the people who are using it in the communities.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Any further questions for Mr. Levine? All right. Thank you very much. Any further questions about the resolution? Seeing none. Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Joint Resolution Version 34-LS0769/N, as in Anilchik, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. Legislative legal has the authority to make any technical and conforming changes.
Are there any objections? All right. With that, seeing none, SJR 20 version N will move from committee. And I will ask members to sign that document at the conclusion of our meeting. We'll move on now to Senate Bill 208. 208 is agriculture land leases. We heard the introduction of this bill last week. And Senator Bjorkman, if you could give us a brief recap along with your staff, Laura Ashi.
Thank you very much, Chair Giesel. For the record, again, Senator Jesse Bjorkman represented the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. Senate Bill 208 performs the essential function of putting more farmers on the landscape to grow food for Alaskans by making our leasing program much more user-friendly and allowing state land to be leased by farmers for the purposes of growing food. Currently, there are a very limited number of state leases, and some of them are very old. And our current procedures in regards to leasing land are antiquated and cost prohibitive to farmers. This bill seeks to rectify that situation by providing a common sense and accessible lease program.
Very good. Thank you. At our last meeting, we addressed a committee substitute, version H, of this legislation, and I neglected to remove my objection to adopting that version. So I'm going to remove my objection to version H now. Are there any other objections to version H, 34LS0832/H, the committee substitute? Seeing none, it is before us then as our working document. Now, this morning, we received another committee substitute, I believe. Senator Bjorkman?
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, Jesse Bjorkman, Kenai Peninsula. Yes, indeed you did. As this bill goes through the process of engaging with stakeholders as well as the Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Agriculture, it now is back and even better than it was before. And my staff member, Ms. Laura Ashe, is here to explain the changes, if the committee desires, from version H to version T, as in Tanana.
All right. Well, first we'll adopt the committee substitute. So, Senator Wilkowski.
Madam Chair, I move the committee adopt the Senate Resources Committee substitute for Senate Bill 208, Work Order 34-LS0832/T, as in Tionic, as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion, and so I will invite Ms. Achi to take us through the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Laura Ashe. I'm staff to Senator Jesse Bjorkman, and I would be happy to walk the committee through the changes found in version T, as in Clinkett potatoes.
Very good.
First of all, thank you to Senator Wilikowski's question at the last hearing regarding agricultural purposes versus agricultural uses. One change is that the legislative drafter did do a sweep for consistency, and we're going to be going with agricultural uses in the legislation. The first change is in within sections 1 through 3. That is the section that governs the ability for the Department of Agriculture to put a merit-based test on selling agricultural land. In version H, that was a buyer-driven process. In version T, that is a department-driven process. The department will select the parcels that are available and offer them for sale the same as they would do under their highest bidder version of auctions, which they do still also retain that ability in statute. So this is a new program alongside that. So that's the biggest change in this part of the bill. We see a change in section 2 that asks the department to publish a schedule of the price per acre for those solicitations that they're doing on a merit-based basis, and allows that the prices may be below the market value. In section 3, that's where the change is actually made that makes it a department-driven process, and also puts in language requiring that the Division of Mining, Land, and Water consult with the Division of Agriculture when scoring applications. I would also say, Madam Chair, at the last hearing, Senator Klayman asked some questions about our feelings on having government score private sector business proposals. They are very well taken. I did discuss that the scoring rubric would be based in regulation, based on which allows for a comment period from the industry. But also, I was reminded after the hearing that the Division of Agriculture does review and approve or deny all of the loan applications for the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund. So they do have the capacity to make judgment decisions on the viability of an agricultural proposal. Then we go to the leasing section of the bill, which is in sections 4 through 9. A lot of these changes they're not as dramatic as what we did in the sales. These are more refining and just making the program more workable. One change is to change the lease terms from 10 to 20 years. This is important because in order for a farmer to get financing, they can struggle to get that financing if they're on a property for only 10 years. Banks want to see more of that longevity in being able to do the work that will allow them to repay their loan. So in Section 6 and Section 8, the lease terms change for both the initial lease term and the renewal from 10 to 20 years. Other changes in Section 8, which is the heart of this, where the new program is created in the bill, would be requiring that the approved agricultural development plan, including the timeline, be incorporated into the lease terms. This is important, too, because we're talking about the department being able to oversee a farmer's progress on the land. Are they actually being productive? Are they not? And so having that, the timeline and the plan be part of the lease allows the department to use that when they're evaluating whether or not the farmer is meeting the terms of their lease. We've also allowed added language allowing the leases to be sublet or transferred with department approval. There's also language because the lease terms are being, or because the agricultural plan is being written into the lease terms, there's also language that allows the department to modify that lease if it deems it necessary, if there's an illness, an injury, economic conditions, whatever other reasons that would make it necessary for the department to approve changing the timeline or the production plan that's in that lease. We again added requirement that the Division of Mining, Land, and Water consult with the Director of Agriculture in scoring the applications. And we changed the definition of agricultural use. In statute right now, there is a definition of agricultural use that this definition was based on. We had taken the parts of the definition that discuss use of gravel on the farm and removing and disposing of timber. We had taken them out of the definition because we heard feedback from stakeholders that they were concerned that someone might spend 10 years cutting down a few trees here and there, and that under the law, they would have met the terms of their lease. They were using the land for agricultural purposes. So we took it out and just made it as allowed in version H. But the feedback we got from the department was that that was a problem because for whatever period of time at the beginning of a person's lease that they were clearing, removing timber or bringing in gravel, they would be in violation of state law. Therefore, we did need to make that an approved agricultural use. And then the department reminded us that they would be using that person's agricultural plan and timeline in their review of, is this person being compliant? So at the request and suggestion of the department, it was those two bullet points were moved back into the definition of agricultural use. In Section 9, we do have a conforming change giving the lessee first preference to purchase the land they've been leasing. That was already in version H, but this was just a refinement of the language. And then finally, in Section 11, version H had the ability for the department to assess civil penalties for folks who were not following the agricultural covenants on land that they had purchased from the state. We refined the language a little bit. We just want it to be, the department is not interested in immediately running out and lowering the hammer on everybody they find who might be in a violation. But we also just wanted to make that clear in statute that the civil penalties are there as a tool, but not as a first recourse. And so that language was just softened just a little bit to make it clear to everybody that that's the intent of the legislation. And with that, if there's any questions.
Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So I just want to, earlier we had a handout, and it was from Emily Garrity. And how will this piece of legislature help her?
Well, through the chair, well, to the chair first, Madam Chair, Ms. Garrity is here. In person, unexpectedly, well, a little bit expectedly, but not on the script. And so if she's willing to come forward and answer that, I'd be happy to have her do that.
Thank you. That would be great. Ms. Garrity? Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and answer Senator Rauscher's question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Emily Garrity, owner and operator of Twitter Creek Gardens out of Homer, Alaska. And through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Rauscher. That's a great question. Because I've been trying to go through the leasing application process for the last 4 years, Senator Bjorkman graciously has taken on the efforts to help change the statute language to make it more possible. The main thing that I'm up against is that fee structure, which Section 8 does address as far as helping me personally in the time frame that I need it to. I'm not totally sure. So that would be probably a better question for Ms. Longacre or Senator Bjorkman or Ms. Shea. Because I guess just to clarify that, my final finding and decision for my lease application came in last August, and it times out after a 1 year period that will be, so this August 2026, and I don't know how long it takes to get statute changed or adopted and if that would actually help my personal process, but I do see that it would help farmers moving forward.
Follow-up, Senator Rauscher?
No, thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I had a couple of questions about for the bill sponsor and staff about the
well,
the proposed CS.
Well, pause for one moment then. Any other questions for Ms. Garrity? All right, well, we'll let you step back. Thank you.
Madam Chair, right. May I add a little bit to that answer as well?
Sure, and then we'll go to Senator Myers.
So for the record, this is Laura Ashe, staff to Senator Bjorkman. You do have Ms. Longacre on from the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, but I would add that I understand that the division's hands are tied with regard to the lease rates that they can offer, so that Ms. Garrity is going to be asked to pay the same rate that a mining company would pay to have access to that land. So one thing that the legislation does is it allows the state to offer rates that are below the market rate. The other thing is that Ms. Garrity and other farmers who are seeking to lease land for agricultural uses have to do a appraisal and a survey, which is very costly. It can take a very long time to get done, especially if you're looking at a parcel off the road system. And this would allow the department to waive that requirement. In fact, it kind of reverses it and says that they only have to do the survey or appraisal if the department determines that it's necessary. So that's another cost savings, recognizing the fact that the profit margins on farming are very different than the profit margins on some of the other folks who come in to use land commercially.
Would you like to ask further questions, Senator Rauscher, to Ms. Longacre?
I think so.
All right. Ms. Longacre, she is the Chief of Operations, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Department of Natural Resources. Would you restate your question, please, Senator Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you very much, the Chair and Madam Chair. So this bill, we have Emily Garrity's farm. And she, according to the handout, and I have talked to her before I even saw the handout, so she is being charged an exuberant amount of money for a small amount of acreage. But I'm wondering how this bill will be able to help her out in her particular situation with her what she wants to do with the land and the limited amount of money that she could make it, as opposed to a mining outfit.
Thank you. Ms. Longacre, could you respond to Senator Rauscher?
Yes, I can. Again, this is Rachel Longacre, Chief of Operations. Senator Rauscher, through the chair, Ms. Garrity does have a final finding and decision for the parcel that she applied for. However, we can certainly use that same information and work with her for any new bills that might be adopted to help conform to a new final finding and decision. Speaking to the bill, we just received this today, so again, I've not reviewed it in fine detail, but what I've seen, survey requirements would be at the discretion of the director, as well as appraisals to be established by fee rates for regional pricing. Both of those components would assist her greatly, because the appraisal costs are going to be based, well, there wouldn't be an appraisal, it'd be based on our division establishing an appraisal rate for that classified land in general. And then the survey requirement could be eliminated. I cannot speak to the details of her parcel specifically, again, without reviewing it. However, could be either eliminated or at the time that boundaries become questionable, and then the director can require it at that point. So it's more of an assessment rather than a requirement.
Does that answer your question, Senator Rauscher?
I think so. Thank you, Madam.
All right. And of course, that is in theory, because the bill hasn't passed, of course. Senator Myers, did you have questions also for Ms. Longacre?
No.
Okay.
Different line of questioning.
All right. For Ms. Longacre, Senator Klayman.
Thank you. Ms. Longacre, I'm just looking at the sheet that we got from Ms. Garrity that lists the market value of the price, and I hear the reference to that being the value for mining. And I guess the question I'm having some difficulty understanding, that I can certainly understand if below the surface there are mineral assets that are very valuable, and figuring out what is the value of those mineral resources below the surface. But if you have land that actually doesn't really have much in terms of mineral value, how can land come up with the high value that is showing up for Ms. Garrity's property, or does it actually have significant mineral value, just nobody wants to develop it? I'm curious about that from market value, because I certainly know there's places where there's a market value for minerals, but there's other places where there's like no market value for minerals.
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Klayman, let me clarify that the parcel was not evaluated on the basis of mining. Ms. Garrity is relating it to the same process in which we would evaluate land that would be leased potentially for mining. The subsurface or the mineral estate is not in consideration for this parcel. We have already looked specifically at this parcel and have determined that there is no mining activity or mineral estate of value and therefore is available for surface use for leasing.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm wondering why, at least on the sheet you provide us, there's so much greater expense or greater value in terms of the proposed lease fees for this property compared to others that she's shown us.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, this parcel is located right in the middle of highly used area for recreational use. It is prime land, and we are trying to work with Ms. Garrity under the statutory authorities we have now to create a compatible use. Ms. Garrity has been working with the Trails Association very, very well, and they have very strong compatible use. However, the land itself does have a high recreational use. And then the area around Homer that we're assessing it by is also very high dollar. If this land and the comparison, those lands that it's being compared to are not sitting right in the middle of high value residential areas.
Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Longacre? All right, seeing none. Senator Myers, did you have a question for Ms. Ashi?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've got a couple of different questions here. So first off, I'm looking at Section 2 of the new CS, and it's talking about doing a schedule of prices that's based on the region. So my question is, when you'd be publishing a schedule of prices, would the division be publishing a schedule based on the region only, or then would that schedule of prices also be different by parcel?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I would actually like to throw this one to Ms. Longacre. That was language that they provided to us.
Okay, then.
I think she's, yeah.
Apparently I was incorrect. I do have a question for her.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Longacre?
Yes, for the record, this is Rachel Longacre. When we set a market value, we're assessing both the use and the region. So it would apply in both ways.
Follow-up, Senator Myers?
Yeah, so if you're doing it by region then, so you would set the same per acre price for, you know, for example, a parcel of land that's already next to a road and has a power pole nearby compared to a piece that's, you know, 4 miles off the road and there's no power nearby?
Senator Myers, through the chair, I do not have a strong background in appraisals, but what I can tell you is all of those considerations come into those different market rates, and they are set in very general terms, and they are at a significantly reduced value in the sense that the applicant does not have to go out and get a survey that's going to take in more specificity in the land. I can follow up with the committee if it pleases with a couple of examples, hypotheticals, if this authority were to come into play for us.
Follow up?
Just that I'd appreciate that. And then I've got another line of questioning.
Yes.
on the bill as well. So
feel free.
Yeah. So Section 9 on the switching from a lease to a sale. I'm looking at the language there, and I'm concerned that, you know, usually if you want to switch from a lease to a sale, you'd probably give the lessee a first right of refusal. But the way I'm reading the language in what's being added, it doesn't look that way. It looks like it's still very much optional to the state. And, you know, so if it's in the best interest finding of the state, then we'll allow the holder, as opposed to, no, if we're going to sell it, the holder automatically gets first right of refusal without a best interest finding. It feels like the land could be sold out from under a leaseholder in that way. Could you clarify that a little bit?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, and this is Laura Ashi. I know Ms. Longacre is on as well, so I always want to make sure that it's clear which one of us is speaking. So if we actually look at page 8, line 6, section H, that is the provision in the new program that gives a lessee the first preference to purchase their land. Over in Section 9, that's some existing land in statute, and so it's conforming language that's being written into Section 9 so that that statute doesn't conflict with what is in section, in paragraph H of section 8. But, I mean, we can certainly take another look at that. This is part, this new language on lines 21 through 24 of page 9 are new to version T. And so we can certainly take a look at that with the drafter and make sure that it's not undermining what it is that we're intending to do over on page 8.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
All right. Further questions on the bill for the bill sponsor or staff? All right, seeing none. I will, in that case, remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute version T. Are there other objections to adopting that version T, as our working document? All right, seeing none. At this point, I was going to set the bill aside. I will set an amendment deadline for it for Wednesday, April 15th at noon. All right. Thank you. Moving on, we are now at Senate Bill 192, Evacuation Designation Levels. This is the first hearing of this bill. And here to speak to the bill is Senator Bjorkman and his staff, Ms. Ashi. Welcome, if you would take us through the bill.
Thank you very much again, Chair Giesel and members of the esteemed Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, and I represent the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. Emergency managers from around the state have requested Senate Bill 192. The bill would create a statewide uniform standard of emergency communication and evacuation. This would clarify what Alaskans need to do in an emergency when evacuation is needed. The bill establishes the ready, set, go designations with corresponding green, yellow, and red color coding for evacuation plans and requires it be used to plan for emergencies in districts established under AS26.23.073 and in plans developed by political subdivisions under AS26.23.060. Brenda Allberg from the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management is on the phone to answer any questions.
Very good. Are there any questions for the sponsor itself, himself? All right. Then I can call on Brenda Allberg, Senior Manager, Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management. Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and speak to the bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Brenda Allberg. I am the Emergency Manager for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Today, I am representing on the Board of Members, the Board of Directors for the Kenai, the Alaska Emergency Managers Association. Thank you for the committee's time today and certainly for Senator Bjorkman's support. Since last May, when we were able to present to the body and support Senator Bjorkman's efforts, we have continued to move forward with the importance of standardized evacuation messaging. My intent today is to provide you an update as it relates to this bill. Firstly, I also want to recognize the Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management, the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, State Fire Marshal's Office, the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, the Kenai Peninsula Fire Chiefs Association, for their longstanding support of this effort. Next slide, please. The Ready, Set, Go program, while the impetus was around wildfires on the landscape from 2019, and actually prior to that, where across the state we had heavy fire activity and unfortunately mixed messaging going on, which was very concerning, not only for our residents, but also for our visiting population as they moved from one area of our state to another and not understanding what those evacuation messaging was because of the conflicting ready, set, go. Fast forward and in 2019, moving forward, all of the jurisdictions started working together, predominantly the emergency managers, to understand and practicing unified messaging unofficially, but yet together we realize that the importance of having the standardized messaging included the go or level three being indicated as red on operational mats so that folks would know that those are closed evacuated areas. Those are areas of danger. This messaging has not only been designed for our upcoming wildfire season, what we have continued to use while we've been waiting for statute support, but also the planned evacuation can be used for other natural hazards, whether it not, excuse me, in addition to wildfires. Next slide, please. And I'll just briefly touch on each level. In my opinion, I think that as Alaskans, we're always in the state of being ready. That's something I think that we pride ourselves on, to be resilient and independent, but also we're really quick to help each other out. And so in that state of always being ready, our goal is that during an event such as the wildfire, when we ask folks to be in that ready state, that they have themselves ready in the event of a need to evacuate, and of course have already plans in place that they can implement during that level one. Next slide, please. We also know that from past experience, we have residents that hesitate to leave early, and that we want to encourage those that need to leave during a level two get set timeframe is to address those folks that may have mobility issues, have livestock, or certainly large recreational vehicles or equipment that they need time to move out of a potential area that may be evacuated. So we encourage folks during that level two timeframe to move. Next slide, please. Level three, go. That certainly is a time frame where we take the please out of the ask. We're certainly emphasizing people to leave now. The time for planning, time for packing is gone. Folks need to grab their car keys and get out of the area now. Next slide, please. I'm going to take a moment to talk a little bit about management action points and how those are operationalized. So for a wildfire situation, when an incident management team comes into a jurisdiction, they establish in coordination with the emergency manager and the other first cooperators or first responding agencies, they establish management action points as far as at when we would do ready, set, or go based on where a fire perimeter may go, grow or change. And when those maps or management action points are established, those are indicated on maps. And that is where having the standardized language, particularly having go indicated in red, is going to be very important for those public facing maps so folks can understand what exactly we're asking them to do. Along with that, I'm going to share with you examples of the past, and if we could go to the next slide, that really indicated how having a green color for go, because people thought it needed to be a stoplight, really created a confused environment when you can see the red perimeter of a fire was up against a green area. That was indicative of the confusion where folks weren't quite sure where they were supposed to be moving or what was closed. We learned a lot, and that particular fire in 2022, that's really what galvanized the importance of all of us coming together to bringing it forward and having it sponsored by a senator that was visionary enough to bring it to legislation for his changing state statute. Next slide, please. Since, as I was saying, the Swan Lake fire in 2019 and moving through other examples, even as relevant as last year's wildfire activity, we've seen the significance in our unified messaging efforts. And I wanted to just share the examples with you. I don't know that we have the right slides we're working on, but let's go to the next slide here real quickly. Yep. So we'll go ahead and we'll adjust. These are examples of us as jurisdictions working uniformly to indicate to the public the importance of closed areas being in red. The other thing that I wanted to share with you while we're on this slide right here is that since last year, I really want to give a shout out to the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, who has been working diligently with our jurisdictions that have established evacuation zones, that they have created a common operating map that can be utilized by anyone, either public or first responders. These evacuation zones were first established on the Kenai Peninsula a couple of years ago, where we can take each fire district and map them out into smaller zones and shade them according to Ready, Set, Go, and the public can see where those impacted areas are. There's other jurisdictions that have since created evacuation zones for their fire areas. And as a culmination of effort, Division of Forestry Fire Protection has brought it all together. They recently introduced that to the state's local emergency planning association committee at our emergency manager conference a couple weeks ago, and it was very impressive. I can't speak more highly about their efforts. Next slide, please. Just as important as it is to get folks out of harm's way, using the same colors to indicate reentry is equally important. That's where these colors will be very helpful to indicate to folks that have a neighborhood where one area may be open, but another area may not quite be open yet because utilities or roads may not be safe to enter into that portion of the community. So using indicators to assist with reentry messaging is going to be equally important. Next slide, please. And that's the end of my latest update regarding our efforts. I thought it was important to share with you that since we first introduced this bill last year, that we have continued to do a yeoman's job in ensuring that unified messaging is done across the state. And I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Aldberg. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Curious on level two. It says to alert the public that evacuation in the area is imminent. Does that mean it's for sure imminent? Or I'm not trying to parse words here, but I'm wondering if maybe exercise caution is better, or is it 100% certain that there will be evacuation? Can you just talk a little bit about level two?
I think that for us, using the words imminent, or whether it's something that I don't know that we can ever say it's 100% sure that we're going to evacuate that area, because fire, particularly with fire, is so dynamic, dependent on operational objectives as it relates to wind conditions, weather conditions, and topography that can certainly change the movement of a fire. And so I think when we put in the level two set, we're at that juncture where we're letting folks know it's likely that there will be an evacuation to go. And we want to give folks the opportunity, like I was saying earlier, if they have mobility issues or livestock, or they need that extra time to evacuate, now's the time when they need to do it. Because when we get to level three go, there is no time to move anything except get in your car and get out of the area.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski. Further questions for Ms. Aldberg? Yes, Senator. Oh, pardon me, Senator Myers. I'm sorry. I actually had your name written down. Didn't see it. Thank you.
No worries, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Aldberg, you mostly were going over fire, which is what I'm also most familiar with, but you did happen to bring up regarding other natural disasters, and I'm especially thinking about the return portion that you mentioned for earthquake or flood. Is the bill as it is written in such a way that it responds to all natural disasters, or is it only written as it responds to fire?
The chair, thank you for your question, sir. It is written such that it would be for all hazards. And the amendment that has been also put before you will ensure that it is part of the Disaster Act with regards to how jurisdictions are developing their emergency plans or their emergency operation plans, their evacuation plans to incorporate that language from an all hazard perspective.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Ahlberg? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much for your testimonies, Ms. Ahlberg. It was very comprehensive. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 192. Is there anyone here in the room wishing to testify on this legislation? Seeing none, I'm looking online, and there is no one to testify there either, so I'm closing public testimony. I'm going to set an amendment deadline for this bill for Friday, April 17th at noon, and we will hear the bill again shortly after that. Thank you very much, Senator Bjorkman, for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee.
So, announcements related to the committee's work. Last year, the committee considered Senate Bill 174 related to invasive species management from Senator Dunbar. We're going to hear the bill again in an upcoming hearing, but we had previously set an amendment deadline for the bill. We have new members on the committee, so I'm extending that amendment deadline to Wednesday, April 15th at noon. The meeting minutes and recordings are online, so you can certainly refresh your memories watching that. But this will conclude our meeting for today. The next meeting will be Monday, April 13th at 3:30 p.m. The subject will be Senate Bill 280, Oil and Gas Property Tax, Muni Tax, Department of Revenue. Please stay and sign the transmittal document for SJR 20, Marine Debris. At this time, the meeting will be adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:46 p.m.